Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to bring on Mr. Matthew Schwartz. Matt, welcome.
Yeah, hey Rick, how you doing?
Pretty good, my friend, pretty good. You know, we've been talking about human rights, and recently our friends and neighbors in Detroit had to petition the UN to get water turned back on, because it is a human right to water. And I know you, and I know the work that you're doing to protect the water viability and the Everglades wildlife from so many abuses. Why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch, sir, of where we are today with the good efforts of South Florida Wildlands?
Well, okay, South Florida Wildlands. First, can you hear me okay?
I hear you fine.
You hear me fine, okay, because I'm in Lake Worth right now, and for some reason T-Mobile doesn't seem to have a lot of towers here where I am, and signal isn't as good as I'd like it. If by any chance we lose each other, I'll just call back in.
Okay, we'll keep our antenna crossed.
Just let me know, or just shout out if you say I'm fading out, or I'll try to relocate. So I guess you're probably most interested in the oil situation. That's the one that's kind of getting the most attention these days.
Well, it is a big issue right now, and of course I want to hear about some of the other things that you're working on, because you're doing such good work for all the Everglades, and not just for water, but for wildlife and wildlands. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's actually a good lead-in, because although, I mean, of course, obviously I'm a human being, and I'm concerned about quality of life for myself and all the other folks who live here, you know, it is important to realize that we do share South Florida.
And there we go. You're breaking up, buddy. Breaking up is hard to do. Why don't you call us back in, and hopefully we can get you going. And he'll call us back in just a moment. Let me go ahead and we'll put on a little bit of music in the background. Hopefully Mr. Schwartz will be back in just a minute.
Hollis Brown, he lived on the outside of town.
Okay, Mr. Stills, we'll let you go in just a minute. Hello, Matthew.
Hey, Rick, how you doing?
Much better, buddy, much better. Glad to hear you. Okay, go ahead, continue.
Yeah, I had a... suddenly I started to hear some very unusual noises, and then I lost the connection completely. So I'm out on the street now. Maybe that'll work better. So anyway, as I was saying, just as a kind of lead-in, you know, we do obviously are concerned about human beings living in South Florida. I mean, there's about 6 million of us these days living in the Palm Beach, Broward, Miami-Dade area, and then obviously some more living in the Keys and over on in Southwest Florida. There's a lot of people living down here. But as I was saying, we do share this amazing place with a very large diversity of native wildlife and plants, some of which are found nowhere else. And the ecosystem that exists here really is quite unique. And that's, you know, everybody has to have a focus, and that is the focus of South Florida Wildlands Association, is to protect what's left of the habitat that provides, that's the basis for all this beautiful wildlife that are here. I mean, clearly when our tourists come down here, that's what they want to see. And even if they don't get to see it, that's what they're buying postcards of. It's manatees and Florida panthers, and it's clearly not new highways, roads, subdivisions, and it's definitely not oil wells. So we're trying to protect that aspect of life here in South Florida.
So you've been part of a suit to protect the Everglades from heavy petroleum intrusion. Can you talk about that?
Right. I mean, actually, I'm now part of two suits, and one having to do with a particular oil well that was permitted next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, and also, by the way, next to the Golden Gate community, Golden Gate Estates community. So it's actually in between the Panther Refuge and the Golden Gate community. It's a vacant, it's a field that is in close proximity to both the human inhabitants of South Florida and the wildlife. It's more than panthers that use the Panther Refuge. And I'm also involved, that's one well, but I'm also involved in a suit that's trying to stop a seismic testing operation from going in on approximately 100,000 acres of land that was leased to a company called Tocala. And that lease is on 100,000 acres of absolutely gorgeous rural and undeveloped land. Most of it's private. A small part of it, a few thousand acres, is part of the, it's called the Dinner Island Wildlife Management Area. It's just north of the Big Cypress National Preserve and the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge on State Road 29. And that's for seismic testing. That's where the company wants to go in and drill about 8,800 holes in the ground and put dynamite down those holes and blow them up and listen for what's down there, pick up the seismic vibrations and try to figure out where the oil is and what where the best places to drill.
Let me stop you there for just a second. Because I think you're bringing up a critical, really critical issue. Now, anybody who's ever had a cat in their house knows how that cat reacts when something as little as a balloon pops. Now, isn't it true that Florida Fish and Wildlife said, hey, no problem, seismic testing with 8,000 chunks of dynamite in there. The panthers will just love it.
They love it, but essentially they had no comment. And I'm going to get into that. I'm going to get into the role of both the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is our federal agency here in Florida, and our state commission is the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. They go by the FWC acronym. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But what I'd like to try to do, Rick, is just kind of step back and give people a bit of the big picture. There's a lot of curiosity and a lot of interest, not just curiosity, a lot of interest in all the in this, we'll call it an oil boom, this new oil boom of South Florida. And it is an oil boom. It's not just these two, the oil well that I and the seismic lease that I have lawsuits on. There's more to it than that. So I'm going to step back and go back to May of 2013 when I first learned about the oil drilling. And I learned about it because the residents of the Golden Gate community received letters from the Dan A. Hughes Company saying, in case of hydrogen sulfide release, this is your evacuation route. That's how they were told that an oil well was going in on the outskirts of their community. And they were astonished. That's all I can say. They were surprised, and anybody would be, to get a letter like that in the mail. And they immediately started doing research and went to the media. And that's when I found out about it. Nobody had informed me that. And I looked at the map. I saw the location. I said, well, this is just west of the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. It's not a good place to be drilling for oil. But I don't want to. You did ask a question about cats and explosions. Yeah, that's a huge issue. I mean, obviously, I'm not dropping that, but I will come back to it.
No problem.
Cats and other wildlife are going to be impacted about that. But let's go back to this. What happened in May of 2013? So the residents learn about it. They go to the media. Suddenly, I'm reading stories about this. And at that time, I'm living here in Lake Worth. I'm driving back and forth between here and Naples and attending meetings and speaking to the media and trying to figure out what is going on here. Now, this is before I filed any kind of a lawsuit. I'm talking with the DEP officials. I'm talking with people from the South Florida Water Management District, from the Fish and Wildlife Commission, Fish and Wildlife Service, the EPA. I mean, basically, the government agencies. Gradually, the picture comes into focus, what's happened. There's a company in Southwest Florida, and they have the family has a county named after them. It's called Collier County. Collier County is named after the founding father, I guess, the founder of the Collier dynasty in Southwest Florida, Baron Gift Collier. Mr. Collier made a lot of money in outdoor advertising in New York City, you know, putting advertisements in bus shelters and bus stops and things like that, and eventually moved to Southwest Florida and started buying a lot of land, over 1 million acres, as I understand it, all the way from Marco Island to Fort Myers. And as he and the company divested of that land, sold properties, they kept all of the mineral rights, so you could have joint ownership. In other words, a property could be owned by one person, and the mineral rights could be owned by somebody else. So finally, Collier Resources has 800,000 acres of mineral rights in Southwest Florida. And if you picture where those mineral rights are, it runs, there's a trend of oil. It's called the Sunnyland Trend. And it runs roughly from the northwest to the southeast across South Florida. So it starts around the Fort Myers area, runs diagonally southeast towards Miami-Dade. And that's where oil drilling has traditionally taken place in South Florida, primarily Southwest Florida. Now, there's also thoughts that that trend extends beyond Fort Myers into the Gulf, and that's one of the reasons why people want to open up offshore drilling in the nearshore Florida waters. And there is still pressure to do that, in spite of the BP disaster and everything that happened with that. But right now, terrestrial drilling on land does take place. It's been a kind of moderate to small affair, a few wells here and there. It's never been a huge operation. And recently, the Colliers, who run their mineral extraction operation under a company called Collier Resources, I guess the only way I could put it is they decided to go all in. They've decided that now's the time to start making use of all these mineral rights that they've been holding all these years. And that doesn't stop the fact that a lot of those lands, when I talk about the Colliers originally owning 1 million acres of Southwest Florida, some of those lands, a lot of those lands were actually sold to the federal government for public land. So areas like the Fakahatchee Strand and also the state government, Fakahatchee Strand, Picayune, the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, the Big Cypress National Preserve, these were lands that were originally held privately by the Colliers and was sold, but the mineral rights were retained by Collier Resources. So a lot of those lands are the lands that are in fact being investigated and actively drilled right now. They have recently, I guess in the last year or two, leased out 450,000 acres of Southwest Florida to various companies. Tocala is the one that's doing the seismic lease. Eventually, they or another company will be drilling on that property once they know where the oil is or trying to drill. The Dan A. Hughes Company has leased over, I think it's 115,000 acres of many, many private and public lands. There's another company, Burnett, that's leased about 230,000, 240,000 acres inside the Big Cypress National Preserve. They also want to do seismic testing and eventually oil drilling in there. So that's about 450,000 acres that have been leased recently. And to be honest, that's an oil boom. I mean, people have to, you know, I'm pretty familiar with the city of Washington, D.C., which is about 45,000 acres. So take a piece of land 10 times the size of the entire city of Washington, for people familiar with that piece of land, and think that that's the land that they're trying to turn into oil fields. Access roads, oil pads, deep well injection, that's a whole other part of oil drilling. When the oil comes out of the ground, the produced liquids have to go somewhere. But that's the scale of it. And applications keep coming in. And we're fighting where we can. I mean, we're going for the most sensitive lands. I mean, as a wildlife habitat protection organization, the reason for attacking that oil well next to the refuge was obviously that is in primary panther habitat. The seismic operation that I talked about, and that's where you brought up the issue of cats and noises, that is on both sides of State Road 29. Anybody of panther roadkill, as we know, the estimate for panthers kind of shifts now and then, but it's somewhere between 100 and 160 animals that are alive today. Used to range throughout the entire southeast, and actually panthers, cougars, mountain lions used to roam through the entire eastern United States. They're now relegated to the little corner of Southwest Florida, and not all of Southwest Florida. Some of those areas are too wet. They don't provide any habitat at all for a panther. They're really relegated to this small upland area in Southwest Florida, south of the Caloosahatchee River, north of I-75, a little bit south into the west of State Road 29, but it's a small area, so people driving around with Protect the Panther license plates need to know that the habitat that panthers have left is small and shrinking all the time. And unfortunately, these 450,000 acres that have been leased to various companies, just about all of it is in the primary zone of the panther. So it's just an unacceptable, just on that level alone, it's an unacceptable project. Oil drilling, you have to start out, you got to build roads, you got to bring in all kinds, you got thousands of cubic yards of fill material to build roads and pads. You're putting oil drilling operations. Before you start the drilling, you got to pound in this 24-inch diameter steel pipe. They call it the conductor pipe, 250 feet into the ground. That's not drilled, that's pounded in. Then they start the drilling. Of course, with seismic operations, that State Road 29 that runs north of the preserve and the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge, that's the number one road in the state for roadkill because it's going through such good habitat that panthers are going to be crossing that road. It's just a little two-lane road. And you're going to be blowing up 8,800 charges in that area over a period of months, and you're not expecting panthers to be moving. You've also got the problem of intraspecific aggression. When panthers live in a very delicate social arrangement. A male might tolerate some females living within its home range, but he definitely doesn't tolerate another male sharing its home range. So when you have displacement of animals, you have the very good chance of roadkill. You have the very good chance of one male moving into the habitat, the range of another male. Panthers have enormous ranges. A female might have 80 square miles, but a male could have a range of 200 square miles. And those ranges are carefully established and maintained by the various animals that live there. And you've also got bears. You've got black bears in that area. You've got eastern indigo snake. When they set these, before they set the charges off, they're driving all through these 100,000 acres, drilling holes in the ground. They're creating a kind of checkerboard pattern, and they're putting the shot holes in one direction and the geophones, which are going to pick up the sound, in another direction. It's a big industrial operation, low-flying helicopters, low-flying aircraft, staging operations, people walking around through there. And the oil fields that are coming behind it, but these big operations, we don't have a clue how many oil wells they're planning on putting in all these different areas. It's a story that's unfolding as we go along. So maybe let me take a breath at that point.
Sure, go ahead.
Any questions, Rick?
One of the first questions that comes to mind is, here we've got this Dan A. Hughes Corporation and working in partnership with the Colliers. And, they have known, at least since last year, that the public is not going to ignore them. The public is paying attention. And yet, they went ahead and violated the guidelines, the limited, weak, watered-down restraint that the state placed upon them. They could not be bound by it. They went ahead and violated that. You know, what kind of activity can we expect with a company that's already violated just the most genial guidelines?
You know, that's a good point, because what you're talking about, and we'll talk about that now, is the fracking operation that took place. And while the folks listening to this broadcast, while you guys were up enjoying December 31st, New Year's Eve 2013, going into New Year's Day 2014, and enjoying that time, the Dana Youth Company was doing what was called the workover operation in another well that they had gotten permitted, called the Collier Hogan Well, about 10 miles northeast of the well next to the Panther Refuge in the Golden Gate Estates. What they did in that quote-unquote workover operation is they pumped acid and other chemicals under high pressure into the borehole to break it open. And let me describe that borehole. So what they're doing right now, the technology that's being used in Southwest Florida, it's called horizontal drilling. And they're going for a formation that really hasn't been tapped that much. It's called the Lower Sunnyland. So most of the oil that's been coming up, almost all of it, is in what they call the Upper Sunnyland. And over the course of, I think they first hit oil there in the 1940s, it was Humble Oil that was a predecessor to Exxon. And they found oil, I think it was in 1943, And they've taken out, from 1943 until now, about 120 million barrels of oil. Now, that sounds kind of like a lot, but if you think that the United States uses 20 million barrels of oil a day, that's a pretty staggering number, but that's what we use here. 20 million barrels a day, that's 6 days' supply for the United States. So it is a lot. The more important thing is that it's a lot of money, because oil is around $100 a barrel right now. So you take 120 million and times it by 100, it's a big number. It's a really big number. And they think that the lower Sunnyland, which underlies this upper Sunnyland, which is what they've been tapping all these years, has even more. They think that that's the source of the oil. So what they're doing, and I know this is a lot of information, but I'm trying to share it while we have the time. They're going down about 2 miles, down in the 12,000-foot range. And then when they get down there, just to simplify it, they're turning a right angle. They're going horizontal about another mile, it's about 4,000 feet. And they have the technology to do that now. They can go down vertical, start turning, get to horizontal, and they've got directional drilling. They can actually look through cameras and see where that bit is and see what's down there. Start pulling up core samples. And in this particular case of the one that we're talking about where the violation took place, they had drilled down, drilled horizontal about 4,000 feet. They have about a 6.5-inch open hole. It's not case. It's just a 6.5-inch hole running along the ground 2 miles below the surface. And they're not getting production. So they did on New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, 2013, 2014, they decided to do a workover operation. They had already run it by DEP and said, wait a minute, we've never done that before in Florida. We've never actually done this, pumping acid and toxic chemicals deep underground under pressure great enough to actually fracture the rock and expand the reach of that 6.5-inch hole. If you think about it, you know, from the engineering standpoint, and you're an oil driller and you're trying to get oil out to sell, it kind of makes sense because you're expanding your reach tremendously by breaking that rock open. The problem is you're pumping the toxic chemicals underneath the aquifers. So they went ahead and they were told, I mean, they basically alerted DEP to the operation. But when DEP learned about it, they said, well, hold off. And they decided not to hold off. And their rationale was, there's no law in Florida that says, and frack. And it really is fracking. They're talking, I mean, they're calling it a workover operation. They're pumping acid and other chemicals in the hole under high pressure to fracture the rock. No matter how you look at it, it's fracking. They fractured the rock to get the oil, and then they prop it open with sand. They pump sand in there after the acids go in to hold those fractures open, and apparently the well became a production well, and they're producing now. They're pulling oil out of there right now and making money. And they were hit with a $25,000 fine from the DEP for doing that, although the use company is still saying, well, that's not really a fine because it was a consent order. We agreed to settle this thing. We're paying $25,000, but we don't admit we've done anything wrong. And the truth is actually that's a little bit complex because we need some laws in Florida. I mean, this is an issue that's going to be around for a long time. This you know, the issue has legs, as people say, and we do need to have some very strong laws that protect how these operations are going to be taking place here in South Florida. You know, there was an article last week in the paper about the little town of Dryden, New York, that actually went to the state Supreme Court and was able to rule that fracking will not take place within their area. That's part of the Marcellus Shale, and they did say they did manage to get that out. So this is all very complicated. With the Dan Hughes companies doing something that they were told to hold off on. They went ahead and did it anyway. I tried to bring it in, by the way, to my trial because I already had the final hearing on my oil well trial, the one next to the refuge. I attempted, once we learned about it. Now, the operation happened December 31st, January 1st. We didn't even know it happened until April. That's when DEP put out a press that took place. And we caught them and we fined them $25,000. That was kind of the gist of it. But my thing had already happened in February.
You're breaking up a bit, Matthew.
I'm sorry. Let me get this. Let's see if I can. How about this? Any better?
A little bit, yeah.
Rick, let me call you back. Let me call you right back in. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
It'll work better if I call in. That seems to work. Okay.
Okay. So you've heard some interesting insight from Matthew on not just the water-related issues, but the wildlife-related issues, and then hear some of the nuance behind this Dan A. Hughes Corporation's agreement to pay $25,000 on a productive well, and I'm sure we'll eventually find out that $2,500 is your basic drop in the bucket. Okay, here we go. Back to Matthew. Matthew, welcome back.
Hey, Rick.
Okay. Oh, much better.
Good
much
to
better.
Be back. Anyway, so we're talking about wheelings and dealings with the Dan Hughes Company and the DEP. It gets really convoluted because, as I was trying to say, I tried to bring that issue up in my case, trying to get the judge to say, hey, you know, there's a Florida state law that says that the behavior of the company should be looked at when the DEP decides whether or not to give a permit or not. And the judge ruled, well, your trial was over, and we only kept it open a little while longer, so the Big Cypress Swamp Advisory Committee could meet. That's a whole other technical thing that happened during the course of the trial. Sorry, I'm hearing some leftover fireworks going off. I don't know if you can hear that.
Oh, yeah, that's
but,
okay.
yeah, we'll just leave them on for some background.
Yeah, we'll take your testimony beneath the rocket's red glare.
Yeah, it's a kind of unusual sound. But anyway, I was not successful in getting that in. I was very disappointed at that because I thought it should have been part of the record of the case that the judge would look at, you know, the fact that DEP ignored the behavior of the Dan Hughes Company when they issued yet another permit, and there was a trial going on for that permit. Things are changing. You know, this story has become a rapidly moving target, Rick. There's so many convolutions to it because, you know, when I was sitting there, and I represented myself, by the way, I didn't have an attorney, I didn't have the money for one, my organization, nor myself, and I was just so involved in that oil well, and I didn't want to let it go through without a fight, and I represented myself pro se. And there on the other side of the room was DEP and the Dan Hughes Company essentially double-teaming me. Now suddenly things are changing. Suddenly DEP is acting like a regulatory agency, like actually looking at what this company is doing and how they're doing it and looking at their behavior and writing them sternly written letters that are coming out as press releases. Like, for example, a week or two ago, DEP wrote Dan Hughes Company a letter saying that you must now hold 3 public hearings on all of your operations and answer all questions having to do with your operations. They've since kind of changed that and say, well, public hearings where people could make public comment. And as far as I'm concerned, that's not going to fly. I'm not interested in having the public. I mean, I am interested, of course, in hearing what people have to say. But the public is not the one who has to provide the answers. It's not going to be enough for the public to stand there in front of a microphone and talk to representatives of the Dan Hughes Company saying, we don't want you here. I'm not interested in hearing that. I'm interested in asking the not only Dan Hughes Company, I mean, I have a lot of questions for them we could talk about, but I also still have questions for DEP. I have major questions for the Fish and Wildlife Commission, for the Fish and Wildlife Service, and questions for the South Florida Water Management District. I've had innumerable phone conversations with these people, face-to-face conversations, conference calls, emails going back and forth. And there are still many, many things about, let's just take the Dan Hughes Company. Let's see what we don't know. They've leased 115,000 acres from the Colliers for oil drilling. When I asked them for a map, they showed me a yellow blotch on a white background and said, here's our map. That's what the map shows. It shows townships and ranges, and there's not a single feature on that map. So the first thing I want to see, the very first thing I want to see, is a map of the 115,000 acres with features that are there on the map so I can see what part of the 115,000 acres is inside the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. It's inside the Big Cypress National Preserve. the Picayune State Forest, the Fakahatchee Preserve State Park, the Corkscrew Regional Ecosystem Watershed. These are the lands that they've leased. But there's no map. They haven't produced any map, and they're saying that's confidential information. That doesn't fly. They need to provide us a map that shows exactly what they've leased. Secondly, we need to know what they're planning on doing with those 115,000 acres. Where do you plan on putting oil wells? They're not doing seismic operations. They're actually applying for drilling permits. How many oil wells are you planning on putting in? Where are the access roads going to be? How many pads are going in? All of these things, if you're looking at it from the standpoint of wildlife and habitat, you can't even begin to make that kind of an evaluation over wide-ranging species like panthers, black bears, eastern indigo snakes, crested caracaras, fox squirrels. Those are all the critters that live in that area. So they are not providing us with any kind of details about their future plans in Southwest Florida. The Water Management District, they were on a conference call that I was on back a year ago, July of 2013. We were talking about the specific wetlands that are adjacent to this oil pad. I know that area. There's topographical maps that show a strand called Stumpy Strand flowing to the east and to the south, right adjacent to this oil pad. Water Management District had no idea that that was there. I said, well, where does the ditches? You're saying, well, the area where the pad is going in is not a wetland because it's been ditched and the ditches drain it. I said, where do the ditches drain into? We don't know. Those are the kind of questions. If there's a spill, you got to know. I know, actually, if you look at the topo maps, you can see that the ditches eventually drain into the wetlands of the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge and flow under I-75 into the Picayune Strand State Forest, which is receiving hundreds of millions of dollars for restoration. So now the headwaters of the Picayune Strand State Forest is going to have an oil field on top of it. And, you know, I could go on and on, but those are the kind of questions.
Let me ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Many of us who've dealt with what is generously called Florida's Department of Environmental Regulation or county or South Florida Water Management is aware that all too often the reason they don't know things is because they actively don't want to know things. Because if you have the data, then you have to react to the data, so they just as soon not have the information. You know, when I hear from water management or from the fish and wildlife that they don't know about some of this stuff, it's clearly not because, you know, granted, funding's limited, but you can't have this kind of, if you will, corporate involvement, corporate engagement in the environment without, if you're being responsible to what your duties are, not knowing. Let me ask you a question. When a local commercial enterprise has to put up a seawall or has to do some dredging, there's an EIS, Environmental Impact Statement, required. Why are there no environmental impact statements for this 8,000 wells for dynamite or the drilling or these pads?
Yeah.
Why is there no EIS required for those? Who's waiving that requirement?
Well, yeah, that gets into some real complicated policy. I mean, part of it is, so federal agencies do environmental impact statements as part of what's called NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. Right. They're required to do it. But those are federal actions or where a federal permitting agency is engaged. And the truth is that the this is private. This is, in other words, this is being looked at as a small operation, mostly private, a private operation on private lands. That's how it's being essentially described. That the federal side of it, or like the Fish and Wildlife Service, we don't have any dog in this fight. Those are not jurisdictional wetlands, meaning they're not connected to navigable waters. And therefore, the Army Corps of Engineers doesn't get involved. The Fish and Wildlife Service has kind of taken a hands-off approach. They did finally write a biological opinion after I pressured them quite a bit, and other people pressured them on the Tocala, the seismic lease, and said, well, it's only temporary. It's just they're going to be in and out, so we won't, there's no problem. The Fish and Wildlife Commission, the State Commission, has also requirements to consult. And there it gets pretty strange, too, because they're taking the position. I mean, they said publicly, look, there's been oil drilling going on in Southwest Florida since the 1940s. We still have panthers. I guess they're compatible. There's no impact. And, you know, or if there is an impact, again, it's just local. But we don't know what local means when we don't have a clue how many oil wells are going in. It's also being contradicted because in 1991, the National Park Service, who manages the Big Cypress National Preserve, did write an environmental impact statement for the preserve that included oil and gas operations since that land was permitted. It's actually written into the enabling legislation for the Big Cypress National Preserve that oil drilling is an allowable activity. And, of course, a lot of that land came from the colliers who hold the mineral leases under the preserve, so it's kind of not a surprise that the enabling legislation for the reserve would include that. But nevertheless, it was done under the NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act. A full-blown EIS was written, and it showed lots of impacts. It showed that oil drilling on at every phase, in other words, seismic operations, drilling, production. So drilling and production are different. Obviously, once you know, drilling is when you're actually drilling the hole in the ground. Production is when you're taking the oil out and, of course, disposing of the other fluids that come out of that well. And then reclamation, all four phases definitely have impacts on wildlife, vegetation, and wetlands. And that EIS was not even looked at by the local Fish and Wildlife Commission when they basically, I mean, they wrote a response to the DEP's request for consultation. So DEP did say, hey, look, here's an oil well going into next to the Florida Panther National Wildlife Refuge. What do you think? And after weeks and weeks of no response, they finally wrote a response, and the response was, we have reviewed the application. We have no response. Have a nice weekend. That was the Fish and Wildlife Commission's official response to DEP's request for consultation on an oil well next to the refuge. So, you know, this is what got me to represent myself in court. Not something I wanted to do. You know, as Abraham Lincoln said, there's a saying, what is it? Anybody who represents themselves has a fool for a lawyer.
Yeah.
And this was not an easy thing to do. This is not an easy thing to do. I'm not a lawyer. You know, it took me quite a bit. It took quite a bit out of me to go through that process. But it was just so infuriating to sit there and see one agency after another kind of say, no, it's no problem, no problem, no problem. I think what's starting to happen now, people that are seeing, and these are, you know, numerous news articles now appearing in the Southwest Florida press, to some extent beyond, but mostly it's most of the news is coming out in Southwest Florida, is DEP is suddenly taking on a different role. They're no longer in this kind of collaborative relationship, which is definitely the way it looked in the beginning. You know, in fact, conversations that I had with their permitting people. I mean, they're a bunch of, you know, they're engineers and geologists. I mean, they're civil servants. They've been doing this for a long time. And as we talked, I mean, they were the first people to admit that we don't know anything about hydrology. We don't know about vegetation. We don't know about Florida panthers. We don't even know there were any Florida panthers there. To them, it's just a geological engineering project. They want to know that the pipes are hooked up correctly, that there's plastic sheeting sitting on top of the oil pad to connect, to collect any oil that spills, that the pad has a 2-foot berm around it to supposedly prevent oil spills. You know, one of the DEP guys, one of the lead guys doing the permitting, he appeared at a advisory committee meeting, and he was asked about a spill contingency plan. And he says, well, look, you know, there could be spills during exploration. You could have oil spills. You could also spill the drilling fluids. You could have diesel fuel spills because there's four generators running this operation, but there's no requirement for one. So here you've got, you know, so that's another thing that even when you got an oil well going in next to these sensitive public lands, some of the most important, I would really say some of the most important wildlife habitat in the country, because Southwest Florida has a degree of biodiversity that's not found almost anywhere else in continental United States. And yet, an oil well can go in with no spill contingency plan. So, there's so much work to be done. It goes on and on. I mean, there's legislation we need. We need to get these agencies off their butts and involved and really taking, you know, NEPA calls it a hard look, they got to take a hard look at the environmental consequences of a project before the project goes in. That means the impact on all of these things we're talking about, the vegetation, the hydrology. We're barely even talking about, we haven't even touched that topic yet, the underground water supply, the aquifer.
Let's talk about the aquifer for a second. As I recall, is it 5 million gallons a month that each well will require?
Well, yeah, and yeah, I don't have the numbers in front of me, Rick, but that's probably about right. But that's probably about right. But 5 million from the water management district's point of view, that's a insignificant amount of water. Because, for example, when I was doing, I don't know if you remember the, remember when Corrections Corporation of America wanted to go into Pembroke Pines and Cooper City?
Right.
That gigantic immigration prison?
Right.
You remember that?
Yeah.
So I was involved in that project very much and spent a lot of time on the impacts to the water supply from a project, you know, 2,000-bed immigration prison 1 mile from the Everglades. And I learned quite a bit about water consumption. So Pembroke Pines has a daily consumptive use of about 16 million gallons a day. So when you're talking about 5 million gallons a month compared to that kind of operation, and only during the drilling, because, you know, that's when you're using the water to produce the drilling fluids that are basically lubricating the hole and also lining the hole, because so the hole doesn't collapse in on itself while they're doing the drilling. So I've also learned a lot about petroleum engineering. That's what they do with this water. So from the water management district's point of view, they just said, look, that's an insignificant amount of water. There is the possibility that that 5 million gallons a day taken out of or a month during the wet, during the dry season could impact the surrounding wetlands. But I think the bigger issue, I mean, if we're going to put it in perspective, the bigger issue is not the drawdown from the fresh water they're using to produce the drilling fluids, but the fact that the aquifer in all of South Florida, and where we live in Southeast Florida, it's the Biscayne Aquifer, and that's a surficial aquifer. In Southwest Florida, it's also a surficial aquifer. It goes down only about 200 feet. In fact, the wells in that Golden Gate Estate, one of the property owners right next to that proposed well, his well is 40 feet deep. So obviously anything coming out on the surface 1,000 feet from his house with all these different chemicals, like I said, diesel fuel, drilling fluids, acids, oil itself, and all the other, when the oil comes up, it's often coming up with produced water. It's highly brine, saline water, mixed with other, they call undesirable constituents, including things like arsenic and heavy metals. And all of that is kind of mucking around on the pad. This stuff getting down into the aquifer, and then you add to it. Now you add to it the, let's call it the workover operation, the acid fracking, where they're pumping acid and other chemicals deep underground under high enough pressure to fracture the rock. And you've got numerous layers of aquifer between the surface and that 12,000 feet. Now, that's pretty far down. That's true. It is pretty far down. But water moves. We're dealing with different layers of limestone. Limestone is a highly, highly porous rock. It's barely rock. It's fossilized fish meal. It's mostly coral that's basically gone through this conversion process and become limestone. It's extremely porous. It dissolves. And that's why we have the aquifers that we have. Now, you're mixing oil and other chemicals with these different layers of aquifer, and not only do you have the possibility of chemicals migrating through the pressure, but you also have the problem of pipes leaking. Did anybody ever hear of a pipe leaking?
Unfortunately, yes.
They leak. I mean, pipes leak, and you've got toxic chemicals running up and down these various pipes. One of the big concerns about the oil well next to the refuge is that the plan is for a deep well injection well to go in next to it, 2,500 feet down. So the oil well will be about 12,000, but the well where they're going to pump stuff that comes out of the well, the produced water and the flowback chemicals, is about 2,500 feet down. And it's running down into this, what they call the boulder zone. Is the boulder zone, I mean, when you pump stuff down 2,500 feet, is it just gone? It's all connected. The confining layers between the aquifers are very porous. Water and waste could move laterally. It could move up and down. That's your drinking water. And if you keep doing it, and that's why I say we need to know how many wells are going in, you're going to start doing this on the scale of 450,000 acres of more oil wells and more deep well injection wells, and you're pumping the water underground, and it's all going to just go where? It's not going to stay in one place. It's going to move. The boulder zone is like caverns under there. That's why it's called the boulder zone. It's not densely packed. It's fairly open. And where this stuff ends up is anybody's guess. People don't have a great model of what's down 2,500 feet down. They have very little model of what's down 12,000 feet down, which is why they're doing the exploratory drilling, why this thing is called a wildcat well, because they don't know what they're going to find when they get down there. So essentially, Collier Resources and these folks that, and I'll be honest, you know, to me, this is being driven by Collier Resources. You know, it's the Dan Hughes company, and later on it'll be the Tocala company and Burnett and all these different companies that the Colliers are leasing their mineral rights to that are getting the attention in the news. But the truth is, this is Collier Resources. They own the resource. They own the mineral rights. They're the ones who decided that now is the time to exploit that resource and start bringing in these drilling companies. This is what, you know, I've looked a little bit up on Dan Hughes company. They're an international drilling company. They drill all over the world, including the Amazon. So they're kind of an off-the-shelf driller, and they're just doing what they do. They drill.
Well, Matthew,
the Colliers are part of the community.
I want to thank you so much for your time and your information. If there is a way for people to help you, how can they get in touch with you to support your work?
Well, I'll tell you, as you can hear, this is, you know, we could have gone a few more hours on this topic.
Well, we will.
I'm a pretty
busy
guy. The best that... We will in the future. Okay, what I think people, the best, I've got somebody helping me with the website. It's taking some time for me to get it up and running. So the first thing, but they can go to my website, southfloridawild.org. There's very little up there right
seconds.
Now. I'm going to be renovating that soon. They should go to the Facebook page. Just look up South Florida Wildlands Association on Facebook. We have a rocking Facebook page. We've got about 8,600 people following that page right now, having lots of good discussions, arguments, agreements, whatever we do. Whatever this organization does, we throw it up on the Facebook page. It's a very easy medium. The last thing people could do out there in radio, in internet radio land, if they feel moved by what's going on here and how difficult this work is, they can go to our Facebook page, or they can go to our webpage and click on the donate button and make a little donation. This stuff costs money. Everything I do costs money. And it helps. It really does help to be able to do this kind of work. And we didn't even touch on some of the other issues going on with wildlife in South Florida. We focused on the oil in this time. But there's never, all I could say is never a dull moment in
thank
Florida
you so
when it
much.
Comes to protecting habitat.
Take thank
care,
you so
Rick.
Much, my friend. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
This is Rick Spezak, your host, saying
talk
to you next week.